And his disciples said to him, "When will the kingdom come? It will not come by watching for it. It will not be said, 'Look here,' or 'Look there.' Rather, the Father's kingdom is spread out upon the earth, and people don't see it." Hello, and good morning. I'm William Morgan, and you're listening to 42 Minutes, a production of SyncBook Radio and TheSyncBook.com, a weekly conversation with the interesting artists and thinkers of our day. You can find us online at 42 Minutes, and you can reach us by sending us mail at mail@42minutes.com. You can also follow our tweets at Sync42 and at SyncBook. Before we begin today, consider this message from our sponsor.
Please stand by for an important message from the SyncBook Press, Department of Treasury.
The land of the Machine Elves was a happy land. These interdimensional beings enjoyed frolicking through the cosmos, creating odd coincidences and quirky rabbit holes. But recent reports from the Department of Psychedelic Agriculture show that trouble has come to the Machine Elves, upsetting the hidden order of the universe and denying us synchronicity, our most valued resource. For some unknown reason, Machine Elves have begun spontaneously combusting. The question is why? Our latest data suggests a lack of financial donations to the Olympia Sync Summit may be the cause. An amazing gathering of some of the brightest names in the synchronistic arts has been planned for August of 2014. A 42-day campaign was launched to raise funds for this event, but roughly 2 weeks in, it remains severely underfunded. However, there's still time for you to help and participate. You see, this is not just a fundraiser, it is also a ticket pre-sale. For $51, you get an all-access ticket for both days of the event. For $300, you get your 2-day pass as well as overnight lodging. You'll also be staying with the presenters and attendees, a unique chance to spend personal time with fellow syncheads and your favorite artists. Don't miss out on this once-in-a-lifetime gathering. Donate now to save the Olympia Sync Summit, or the world of synchronicity may soon be gone.
Thanks, Alan. Robert Anton Wilson's Dolphins, Terrence McKenna's Machine Elves, what's next? For us, that means rolling out our mats on this 6th day of May for episode number 135 as we get into Downward Dog for some yoga. Wait, is that Downward God?
Well, that's what the Gnostics think anyway, William. Hello, friends. Doug here. And today on 42 Minutes, we have the pleasure of speaking with Swami Antananda Giri, the author of the Yogic Gospel of Thomas, a commentary on the Nag Hammadi Gospel of Thomas. This wonderful book was published at the beginning of this year by SyncBook Press, and I'm tickled to be speaking about it today. It really is fabulous, and I definitely recommend everyone getting one of these right now. But the interesting thing about this is we don't know much about its author. Do we call you Swami Antananda Giri the whole time, or Swami G, or what? How should we call you?
Just Swami works. It's actually pronounced Swami Antananda Giri.
Oh my! Yeah, I don't know if I could do that.
Yeah, my English speaking tongue has issues with it sometimes too, actually. But yeah, just Swami will suffice.
Well, so who are you, and what's your story? Give us a little background if you could.
Okay, the story that took me from that brought me from walking a normal everyday sort of a path, a really mundane one, to what I'm doing now, which at least to me is, well, it's definitely off the beaten path, and at least to me it's important. It's a long story, but I'll try to keep it concise. I guess it's, for me, it starts with an experience that I had that is an enlightenment experience. I mean, it was an enlightenment experience. And essentially that was the experience of self as one with everything else that I could perceive in the world. And there was heightened sense perception also, and it was just a really, words really can't do it justice, so I'm not even going to try. I have taken a stab at it in some of my writings and stuff. You can see that if you look at my blog, stuff like that. But really, it was just the most awesome thing that you could imagine. It's more awesome, at least more awesome than anything that I ever imagined. It was a blissful experience. Everything that appeared to me was new and fresh. And
what were the circumstances of this event?
I had recently, it's interesting that you ask, because it's kind of not necessarily for this particular experience, which was the most profound one that I had had up to that point. The way that I got there wasn't necessarily one that is smiled upon by everybody in a mystic Hindu sort of a circle, but it was, I was exposed to the philosophy of Advaita, or non-duality, and so I went out, I picked a spot that was sacred to me. It's the northwesternmost contiguous point of the United States. It's called Cape Flattery in Washington State, and I went there. I ingested psilocybin with the intent of experiencing Advaita, the state of non-duality, and basically it happened. It's not necessarily a reliable method to get there, and I had issues with it because once the chemical catalyst wasn't in my body anymore, then I went back down to perceiving as I ordinarily did, and I was pretty depressed about that because I was like, oh man, I have to come back here. And
you didn't really want to leave, is what you're saying.
No, not at all. But it put me on a different path. It opened my eyes to like a whole different level of reality that I had never even dared to imagine.
Well, how many years ago was that?
I want to say three, maybe more like four.
And then, out of curiosity, how many years have you been working with the Gospel of Thomas as something that inspires you?
About that long, because I started like devouring all the Eastern philosophy, or I shouldn't necessarily say Eastern, because I studied some Western modes too, but pretty much everything about any wisdom tradition that I could get my hands on. And so the Gospel of Thomas was something that I saw early on. I was like, oh, I kind of get this. I eventually decided that taking a guru was something that I needed to do to speed up my enlightenment. In our tradition, we have there's a thing that's called Sahaja Samadhi, which basically means a natural, effortless absorption in the state that I kind of described, maybe inadequately, but basically the experience that I had, that in the case that I described, happened to be psilocybin induced. But basically the premise is that you can achieve this state permanently and naturally, while you're still embodied, and in the tradition that I belong to, and a lot of the Eastern traditions, you need a teacher. At least they say you need a guide to get you there most expeditiously. So I decided this was for me, and so my Swami teacher at the time, I wasn't yet initiated as a Swami, he recommended that I take a look at the Gospel of Thomas. So I took another look at it at his recommendation. And at that point, I had been studying the different styles of yogic philosophy, particularly Kashmir Shaivism. Mm-hmm. That's the tradition that I come from is philosophically draws primarily from Kashmir Shaivism and Advaita Vedanta.
And if I remember correct, those are kind of two opposing philosophical schools. Is that correct?
Yeah, at face value, they point to the exact same thing. So that's kind of the interesting thing to me about that tradition. Because Advaita Vedanta basically states that one of the tools that school of philosophy uses is a style of self-inquiry that promotes the seeker to ask the question, not so much ask a question, but remind yourself. It's kind of like a repeated affirmation that anything that you look at in the entire field of manifest existence, anything that you can apprehend with any of your five senses is not the absolute because it's finite. If it wasn't finite, you wouldn't be able to apprehend it with the senses. So it's just like a line of inquiry. It's a constant affirmation that what you're seeking is not this and not this, neti neti. Where Kashmir Shaivism promotes an attitude of inquiry more along the lines of everything is God. There is nothing. My guru says there's nothing that is not God. His guru, what did he say? Honor yourself, worship yourself. The self, God is in you. God is within you, as you. Something along those lines. I'm paraphrasing it kind of loosely, but that's basically the gist of it.
It seems like there's a Christian mystic path that's similar, where there are those who go and seek to find God, and then those who go to seek to find themselves. And I think they end up, you know, at the same place. But basic, let's get basic. When we talk about yoga, I mean, in the West, in our time and place, we understand yoga as kind of this meditative stretching. But when you talk about yoga, what does that mean? What is yoga, and what is the goal of yoga? Or purpose, maybe.
Yoga is derived from the Sanskrit word, which means that means to yoke, as in to yoke a cart, like to an ox or something like that. And so it's a metaphor for linking oneself to the divine and basically becoming one with it. The absolute, the Brahman, God, or Shiva, or whatever you want to call it. You could just call it consciousness with a capital C.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily need to be theistic. That's something that a lot of people find helpful, and something that I don't personally discourage. It's an attitude that I hold as well, but there are atheistic Hindu paths, also atheistic yogic paths. But basically, the pinnacle of yoga is to merge into that. You realize, like you said, you're finding the self, maybe you're finding your God, but you find that and you realize that you are that. That's the pinnacle of it. First, you attempt to yoke yourself to it, and eventually you realize that that's just all there is, and you're that also. There is no separation. There is no I and another. There's just I am, and that's it. And it's a pretty heady concept. These ideas, I had come across them in the past, but they didn't really hold any appeal to me because they sounded so abstract. But it's for me, it's just so when you're actually it's about the experience. When you're actually having this experience, all the joy that exists is yours, and it's you, and you're not having that separation there, not having those walls up. It's just something innate about it. An innate part of that state is that it's just bliss. It's called in Sanskrit they say God is Satchitananda, which means existence, consciousness, and bliss absolute. Those are three qualities associated with God. So God is existence, God is consciousness, and God is bliss. And for me, the bliss was the most pronounced part. And it's something that if you become permanently absorbed in that. For me, my current state of development, it's something that you kind of dip into, and then the world kind of drags you back, and then you're like, okay, keep doing practice. And then you go back for, you know, you try to visit as often as possible. But it's about the experience, and it was just something that was so profound and so beautiful that it changed the entire direction of my life, the entire reason that I'm even alive. I don't live to just satisfy my individual desires anymore. I'm here to be a service. If people have questions about these sorts of matters, I'm in kind of a position that I can help kind of point people in the right direction. Also, people that are drawn to this path and are interested in the whole guru disciple teacher student dynamic. Not everybody is. Some people have an aversion to it. Some people, rightfully so. Some people have abused the relationship. But it is a dynamic that I can say from my own experience, at least, can be beneficial in a lot of different levels. Like, I mean, there's the getting the concepts straight that are going to help you on your path aspect of it, and all the intellectual knowledge that might help you on your path. But at a certain level, it goes beyond that. If you're ever fortunate enough to be in the presence of somebody who is self-realized and who is permanently in that state, there's kind of an energetic thing that goes on. The idea in our tradition, we're a Shaktipat lineage. That means that that an energy is transmitted from the guru to the initiate when Shaktipat takes place.
Okay, so what's the difference between a swami and a guru? And could you unpack guru a little bit? Like, what does that come from?
Well, there are two syllables that compose the word gu and ru. Gu literally means darkness. Ru means light. So the word means the light that dispels the darkness is in the darkness of ignorance. So basically, the guru is just somebody who illumines, whose purpose is to somehow illumine your own true nature, your own guru nature within you. They say the guru lives within, but it's kind of clouded over by a layer of ignorance, an idea of separation from all these other things that are out there. And that's kind of what gets in the way. It's essential to being a person and experiencing the world, but it's also what gets in the way of experiencing non-duality. So the guru is just a person whose function is to show that to somebody. And the qualifications of that person, the qualifications for a competent guru is that there are really only two qualifications. They're well-versed in scripture and that they are experiencing that state, that they're either constantly immersed in that state or that they've gone all the way and they can go back there at will. Sometimes you have to kind of bring your consciousness back down to a sense of individuality to interact with the world. Otherwise, you'd just be a lump of meat on the ground and people would have to feed you. And that happens to people sometimes. But that's what a guru is. When I'm talking about a guru, that's what I'm talking about. A swami is a renunciant. I mean, you could ask 50 people who are really well versed on the subject and you'll get 50 definitions, but the most broken down, bare bones version of what a swami is a swami is a renunciant. And, for me, renunciation was a natural side effect of just having that experience that I had. Like, I still walk around as a person through the world and experience it and whatever. I do all the things that all other people do. But
what are you renouncing then?
For me, there is nothing.
Is it the idea of attachment or desire?
Well, that kind of gets burned off as a result of your practice or as a result of these experiences to an extent. And it helps to get rid of that stuff. That's part of the work that we do in spiritual practice in this tradition. I'm not going to claim that I have no desire or no will or anything like that. It's a work in progress. For me, renunciation is it's an attitude more than what a person is actually doing. It's the contents of your mind. So for me, what I'm doing is not self-serving anymore. I'm making a conscious effort to serve other people. I'm still doing mostly the same things, but the intent is to help other people. The intent is for me to become fully and permanently self-realized. So for me, there is still a world, but the world is only, at the same time, all there is for me to become enlightened. Like, if I had to settle for anything less than that, it just wouldn't be enough. So that kind of renunciation for me is just a natural byproduct of having experienced what I experienced, I guess. And some people might say that's bullshit. Okay, whatever, but that's just my take on it.
So right now I'm reading Island by Aldous Huxley. I've got a little bit of a book report for James Corbett on the Corbett Report by the end of the month. And in that, Huxley comes up with this utopian version of civilization that has, you know, been quarantined to this island while the rest of the world, you know, is what it is in the state that we see it now. But anyways, their civilization has used the mushroom as some sort of coming-of-age transfer. And I mean, the island in itself is Buddhist, so, you know, you go into a temple of Shiva and you take this mushroom and you have this religious experience, like, in mid-service. Do you know what I mean? So it's a religious, it's kind of ushered in, it's guided. Have you given much thought into doing that? I mean, giving others the experience that you have yourself and ushering others into that, is that a moralistic thing to do? Have you given this idea any thought at all?
Before I was affiliated with the lineage that I'm affiliated with, I took a handful of people out into nature and tried to share the experience with them. What I found out was it's so unpredictable. It depends. There are so many variables. There's the set and setting. There's I also had to acknowledge pretty early on that what a substance does to one person isn't necessarily what it's going to do to a different person. It really depends on where you're at mentally, where you're at mentally, basically, in terms of what kind of conditioning that you've got going on, because it's, at least according to the philosophy that I subscribe to, it's mental conditioning that reinforces that ego idea that keeps you separate from the experience that we're looking for.
Okay, so maybe that's a direction. So you were saying that your tradition might frown upon the idea of speeding up the process a little bit with the use of, you know, sacred plants. What are your thoughts on longer term use of sacred plants to get there? Do you think that's cheating, or is that just the modality that we're in right now, that all paths are valid and this is one way, like that's a practice, perhaps?
I think everybody's on a path, and I think they're all valid. I think some are more expeditious than others. As far as sacred plants, the entheogens, I have personally found value with them. I don't want to encourage anybody to do anything illegal. I do think the legislation should be changed so that people are just free to experiment with their own consciousness. I think that's an innate human right. But I don't want to encourage anybody. Again, I don't want to encourage anybody to do anything illegal. What am I trying to say? It's just such an unpredictable thing that it's not something that I really. At one point, I was really gung-ho, especially about psilocybin and especially about mushrooms, and I was like, "This is the answer," because this happened to me. But then I realized that's not generally what happens to people. It's a possibility, but I'm not so gung-ho about it anymore. I have to really just stress, you know, use your own best judgment. Because there are potentially really adverse outcomes that, you know, a person can walk away from that sort of experience with. So, I mean, it's really on the individual, in my opinion. I think prolonged use, it doesn't seem to me like it's such a great idea, but it's never really been something like, it seems to me like it could become kind of a crutch. Either you could have good experiences, it could become a crutch, or you could keep not have such a good experience and keep going after it. I think there's the potential for it to become more of a damaging thing than a positive thing. I mean, I've seen a lot of people get burned out.
Is it real, though? I mean, do you think the experience is real? Is it, because a lot of people argue that it just happens in the head and it's not real enlightenment, that it's just a chemical reaction or whatever. And where are you at?
For me, what it felt like was things, there were like layers of things over my my eyes, metaphorically speaking, like a veil, like something that was there suddenly wasn't there, and I was just seeing more of what actually was. I mean, I think that's a good question. It's one that I've come across in people that have had experiences like these, and it's another reason that I don't particularly, nowadays, I don't particularly advocate that route so much. But for me, what doesn't exist in your mind? What isn't just mental? And when you start having these experiences, there are other kinds of experiences that happen and that I've had that I haven't really detailed in length, because there are so many different like degrees and types of samadhi. One of them is one of them is called nirvikalpa samadhi, and it's basically just a state of no mind, of nothingness.
Samadhi, could you define that term?
Samadhi is basically the exact same thing that would be the exact same definition that I gave you for yoga.
Okay.
Becoming one with the absolute, or consciousness absolute, or whatever you want to call it. That's a samadhi experience, and that can happen to varying degrees. One of those experiences is nirvikalpa samadhi, and that's basically where you transcend the mind, and there's just nothing going on, but you didn't stop existing. You come back from it, and you're like, you realize I just meditated for an hour and a half, but it seems like I just closed my eyes.
Okay, this is all very well, good, and interesting, but, I mean, what does this have to do with Jesus?
I mean, question.
I don't understand. And then also, like, you know, I was flipping through my King James version of the Bible here, and I don't find a Gospel of Thomas.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I almost forgot we were here to talk about the book. So Gospel of Thomas is apocryphal. It's one of the apocryphal texts. There are a lot of them because the early Christian tradition was a very grassroots movement. And it turns out, I found out after doing a lot of research, it had a very mystical bent to it. There's not really any denying it. The Gospel of Thomas is one of those mystic texts, and all of these works were circulated in a really grassroots movement. It wasn't really organized at all. People were just talking about stuff they were passionate about, that brought meaning to their lives. And so there were hundreds and hundreds of gospels. Some of them sound pretty crazy if you look at them, but probably had some esoteric meaning that I'm not really going to get into here. I don't want to go down the whole rabbit hole of listing every apocryphal text, but there are a bunch of, and the Gospel of Thomas is one of them. And Gospel of Thomas, if you read it and you have any exposure to Eastern mysticism, it's pretty easy to recognize that that's what they're talking about. But basically, about 2 to 3 centuries after Jesus himself was out of the picture, most of these gospels got suppressed when they created the canon that was eventually going to compose the Bible that we know today. So there's this rich tapestry of history behind the Christian church that's part of the tradition that isn't really advertised anymore. It was actively suppressed for a long time, but it's there and it's part of the tradition. And
this gospel's arranged in something called logons. Is that right? What are those? Is that just verses in a different language, or?
Yeah, I think logion.
Logion.
And I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's based on the root word logos, which means the word. So the Gospel of Thomas is organized into logia. That's the plural of logion. So there are sayings that are attributed to Jesus. It's just a loose collection of things that Jesus is supposed to have said.
The premise of your book, if you boil it down, is that Jesus's missing years possibly were spent in India becoming a master?
Yeah, well, I did make a point of talking about that just to kind of raise the question and put it out there as a possibility. And it does kind of go a long way toward explaining why Jesus is talking the way that he's talking in the Gospel of Thomas. It makes sense to me. And then when I, but you know, I wasn't there, so I just kind of wanted to put it out there so the reader is aware that this is a conversation that's been going on for a long time. This is a possibility. For me personally, my research, because I spent like a year and a half writing this book, and I just kept finding more and more stuff. I could probably still be writing it today if I hadn't made myself stop. But
we should tell our listeners that this book is a commentary, and so you're using the Gospel of Thomas as the backbone, and then you unpack each of the verses. So it's like the compression of the verse you unpack and show, like you lift the veil.
Yeah, at least that's what I tried to do. I tried to kind of, because they're really compact. They're really profound, and the meaning behind them is either intentionally obscured or there's context that's missing. And so I had to do some detective work to uncover some of the contextual information that you kind of need to have to appreciate what's being said. And then some of it is just the sharing of mystical experience or a mystical path. And so the fact that I have a fair amount of knowledge about this kind of stuff just kind of tucked away in my brain kind of allowed me to shed some light on that also, I think, is the value that I was able to bring to the table on uncovering the, you know, kind of the, like you said, unpacking the meaning in these condensed sayings.
Well, I have to, you know, just stop and say that I found this book to be beautiful. Like, every aspect. It has such a nice heft, the beauty of the overall object, but then once you get into it also, it just, it's wonderful. And you can see Alan's fingerprints, and you can see Jason's fingerprints on this, but then, you know, your mystical background really does something special with the Gospel of Thomas. And so I want to thank you, because one of the metrics for success that you set out towards the beginning, if this book helps spare one person a second of the delusive and self-destructive behavior that characterized my darker days, I will consider it a success. And it definitely was very, you know, I found my time with it wonderful. And then one of the other compliments that I heard on the Always Record episode you did with Alan and Frederick and David was Alan said that he read it about 14 times and that it holds up, you know, and that sounds great, you know, and that's my experience too, that this isn't a book you necessarily have to read from start to finish. This is definitely a book that you can spend a nice portion of your life with, just dipping in. So I'm saying thank you, and I do think it's a success by your own metric there.
And yeah, that's the biggest thing I was going for, and so I'm really glad to hear you say that's it's a really big compliment, and I'm really glad to hear that that it hit the mark, and it's gotten. I've been consistently amazed at just how good the feedback is that I've gotten on the book. It was just a sincere effort. It started out as just a sincere effort to help my mother. That was kind of the genesis of it, because I talk about it in the book, but I was raised in a very Christian background. I was very involved in the church. So that's another reason that bringing Jesus into the equation was kind of bringing Jesus into my current sadhana, my current spiritual practice, was kind of a big deal for me. But my mom was having some issues when I started discovering this stuff. I suggested she take up a meditative practice. She started having all these, all these benefits and things like that. But she also had all this guilt from just basically like programming the church had kind of instilled in her, because, you know, when I was a kid, we were both very involved in that. And so I had all these insights, and I wanted to kind of share those and just kind of share the knowledge that this is part of your heritage. This isn't, you know, you're missing part of Christianity if you don't.
Jesus is bigger than Jesus.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Joseph Campbell would say something like that, where people have to smash through their image of Jesus to actually access Jesus.
I'm not really familiar with Joseph Campbell, but that, I mean, it sounds perfectly in keeping with what I'm trying to promote with the book.
And do you think our Western society, we're nearing the end here, do you think our Western society is ready to begin to let some of these divisions drop that we've created, like the body-mind division, or, you know, the material, there's this religious scientific split? It seems like we're a children of divorce. Can we get into a place that's a little more less dualistic, do you think?
I honestly don't know, and I actively try to not speculate on that point, to be honest with you, just because at least from my perspective, the way that I look at it, all I can really do is be here to help. And if something I can say or do like sticks or helps somebody move in that direction, then that's great. That's why I'm here. And I mean, it does. I see it on a regular basis. Just in terms of influencing the whole of society, I don't want to impose any sort of limit on what's possible. Anything's possible. But it would be for me it would be speculation. So I try to adopt more of an attitude of just kind of sitting back and watching it play out while I do my duty.
That was 42 minutes. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Are we all done?
You bet. You've been listening to Swami G on SyncBook Radio, a production of thesyncbook.com. More information about his work can be found under the books tab at thesyncbook.com and at his blog. Could you tell us your blog's address?
It's kind of complicated. I'll give you my web address. It's www.swamiananta.com, and that'll link you to the blog. That'll tell you about the work that I'm involved in. I'm involved in permaculture work, restoring the land. I'm trying to build an ashram, and transform this desert landscape that I'm living in right now into more habitable. Anyway, I'm involved in a lot of work like that. I have the blog, like Doug mentioned, that'll link you to all that, and you can learn a little more about who I am, how that relates to the tradition and the work that I'm currently involved in.
You can also find more information about the Sync Book, our guests, to check out past shows, or subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. Please be sure and visit our website at 42minutes.com. If you like the podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. I mean, you'll find the donation links under each episode on the website, and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much. And if you have ears, you had better listen.
sunset. By which we measure our pain, yeah.
Say.